Sai's glory, his divine story. Every Thursday on Morning Glory. Catch the vibe with me, Karuna Munshi, on Radio Sai's Thursday Live on Asia Stream at 9:40 a.m.
Om Shri Sai Ram. Loving salutations at the lotus feet of Bhagwan Shri Satya Sai Baba, the voice, the ears, the heart and soul of Radio Sai. Sai Ram, dear listeners, and welcome to Thursday Live. You are tuned to Radio Sai's Asia Stream, coming to you from Prashanthi Nilayam, India, the spiritual capital of the universe. My name is Karuna, and it's my divine privilege to be hosting this segment called Morning Glory. And I apologize for my poor voice quality. I'm getting over a virus that has left behind a frog in my throat, so I beg your indulgence for the way I sound today. On the sound console today is audio engineer, Brother Sunil. We are coming to you live from the Radio Sai studios here at Prashanthi Nilayam, where the time right now is almost 9:38 a.m. Thank you for staying with us on this very pleasant Thursday morning, November the 7th, 2013. Prashanthi Nilayam is really quite pleasant right now, as the temperatures have been dropping since Diwali. This week our average lows are in the 18 to 19 degrees Celsius range, and daytime highs barely 30 degrees Celsius. Here's what's making news at this hour in Prashanthi Nilayam. The ashram is just catching its breath after the energetic and energizing extravaganza of Diwali celebrations by the devotees from the West Indian state of Gujarat. From fancy and fast footwork of Gujarati dances to a riot of colorful costumes, folk and classical music to grand dramas, the devotees from Gujarat celebrated the Festival of Lights with great joy and devotion in the Divine Presence, marking the beginning of the festivities galore that Prashanthi Nilayam hosts every November. The Abode of Supreme Peace is all charged up for the upcoming series of celebrations, Global Akhanda Bhajan, Ladies' Day, Convocation of the Sai University, and of course, the most important festival on the Sai calendar, the 88th birthday anniversary of our beloved Lord, Bhagwan Sri Satya Sai Baba, on November the 23rd, 2013. Dear listeners, do brace yourselves for quite a celebration during the week of the Divine Birthday, as hectic preparations are going on for this very special event. We sure hope you're joining us here in Prashanthi Nilayam for the birthday celebrations. You still have time to book your tickets and come home to the Abode of Supreme Peace. And if for some reason you can't be here in person, do join us virtually through Radio Sai. We'll bring you the live webcast of all the major celebrations right here on radiosai.org. Now, let's talk about the delectable menu we are serving you today on Morning Glory. Up first, a recent Tryst with Divinity interview with an oncologist surgeon from the Indian Armed Forces, Dr. Rajneesh Talwar of New Delhi, that was very well received and got us tremendously positive feedback from listeners all over the world. Hence, it warrants a special airing on Morning Glory. Following this special Tryst with Divinity conversation with Dr. Rajneesh Talwar, we will bring you part one of a brand new episode of Fleeting Moments Lasting Memories with Sai University alumnus, Mr. Gautam Dutt. So let's take off Morning Glory with the Tryst with Divinity interview with Dr. Rajneesh Talwar. Sai Ram, dear listeners, and welcome to Tryst with Divinity, our series of conversations with individuals whose lives have been touched and transformed by Bhagwan Baba. Today, we have with us an oncologist whose surgeries and surgical precision is widely featured on YouTube and followed by surgeons around the world. But he is here to talk to us more about the inner surgery, the spiritual nip and tuck that has brought him where he is today. Our honored guest is Dr. Rajneesh Talwar, MS Surgery, Fellow Onco-Surgery, Tata Memorial Hospital, Bombay. Dr. Rajneesh Talwar is a colonel in the Indian Armed Forces Medical Services, and he heads the Department of Onco-Surgery at R&R Hospital, that is the Research and Referral Hospital, New Delhi. Sai Ram, Dr. Talwar, and a very warm welcome to Radio Sai.
Sai Ram, sister. Dr. Talwar, I understand that you first heard about Bhagwan when you were in your 12th standard in your high school in 1978 in Jalandhar, Punjab, because there was some Vibhuti manifestation happening in your uncle's house, but that didn't do much for you.
No. That was 78. I've just entered the medical college and we had information. In fact, I witnessed it also, that there was a spray of Vibhuti in my very dear uncle's house. But my father himself was an agnostic. My mother, though a bhakta, we were told always to be cautious about these phenomena. There's a magic about it, there are tricks about it. And then my mother always guided us that physical gurus are to be kept a distance from. So I, as a partly an agnostic, partly a critic, partly a questioner, never could believe that this could be true. So it did make a place in the heart, yet never manifest really for a couple of years.
I see. But then it was, I guess, in 1991 when you were in the mountains of Uttaranchal. You were a young captain and army surgeon at Pithorgarh. And that's when a picture of Baba came into your life.
Oh, yes. There was a very revered senior officer, a brigadier by rank, Brigadier Tur. He was my mentor in tennis, you know. He used to teach me tennis and I really appreciated his confidence and his persona. He was a very wonderful human being, you know. And he would always raise his hand and bless people and say, Baba sab theek karenge. He was a Sadaji, so I thought that he's talking about Nanak Baba. He never discussed this matter with me. And once I really personally needed some miracle to happen, I wanted some, administrative favor from the army headquarters. And I reached the army headquarters where I found that it is impossible for me to get through and, you know, introduce myself and reach the senior consultant whom I intended to. So I went over to Brigadier Tur. He also didn't have a practical answer. But what he did was he took out a photograph of Baba out of his wallet and put it in my front pocket. And he says, keep this photograph in your pocket. And if it helps you do all that you need, you keep it with you. Otherwise, you tear it off and throw it. I liked the confidence and I liked the magic about the words which he uttered. As a sensible, senior, educated army soldier, that he is believing so much in a photograph whom, yes, I had also heard about in 78 that there are Vibhuti manifests and other things. So I did put in my pocket, and the wonder of wonders, everything happened the way I could have not even dreamt, you know. So this photograph kind of stayed with me. Not that it still made any significant change in my thinking or my lifestyle or my faith, but the photograph stayed with me as a miracle photograph. Whatever I wanted really happened.
Your little genie's magic lamp.
Absolutely, yes.
And your army career, I'm sure it involved a lot of transfers from place to place.
Yeah, from Pithoragarh I was posted to Chennai, which later on I felt that it was all Swami getting me closer to him.
And in Chennai you met another eminent Sai devotee.
Oh, yes. Chennai, I met at that time Colonel Verma. Presently he's looking after the General Hospital here, Puttaparthi. Vice Marshal Verma. Yeah.
Vice Air Marshal Dr. Verma.
Yeah.
Our very own head of our superintendent of our Sri Satya Sai General Hospital.
Oh yes. Again a revered gentleman. He also impressed me by his persona. And I found it intriguing that this photograph of Swami was decorated on his office table.
What? And people can have icons of their liking.
Yes, but as a young man and as a, my grooming was scientific and agnostic and critical. So in my heart I felt objectionable that why should there be a photograph of another human on the office table of my commanding officer. So I did question him, what is this, who is this and why here? He said he's my guru. And I was about 30 at that time. Maybe not even 30. So, I couldn't hide the objection in my heart, welling up in my heart. And I said, why do you need a guru? Oh, he said, that's very personal. He's a man of few words. You may have interacted with him. So he said, that's very personal. Anyway, I questioned that, who is he and would you tell me? So he found at that time it was unnecessary. And a young officer is trying to gain proximity and photograph is becoming a medium. So he brushed the thought aside and he kept the relationship of a professional, of a CO with a young officer. He appreciated me as a surgeon. I was always appreciated as a surgeon. So my clientele and my seniors were always very happy with my surgeries. So that was our relationship. But then I continued to pester him each, so to say, a few weeks. Whenever I go to his office, they said, "Sir, would you not tell me about your guru?" He wouldn't. It was, I think, about 6 or 7 months of my repeated pestering that he gave me a book. And this was Dr. Fenibanda's book, you know, The Vision Divine, yeah. And that's what perhaps did the magic. I read the book and initially it created within me an uproar, a feeling as if there was something abnormal about this gentleman.
Why? What did you think was abnormal about Swami?
You know, Swami, if we are a student of Vedanta, which I had no nearness to, I had not even heard what Vedanta is. So if we are a student of Vedanta, yes, we can comprehend that the truest, the highest Advaita is to know that I am God.
Mm-hmm.
And everything around is God. Mm-hmm. But that was not my case, you know. I had no such information, no such grooming, no such knowledge that there is something called that I am God.
Mm-hmm.
So when I read that Swami is God, the Creator, and he says it from childhood, I actually felt that perhaps there's something wrong and maybe he's a schizophrenic, you know, that he's talking about himself like
yeah.
that. So that was my initial reaction.
Multiple personalities or something?
Oh, yes. But all the same, I was fortunate that I developed a feeling of going over and having a look at this abnormal phenomenon rather than just brushing it away.
Did it help that Dr. Fenibanda was a man of medicine, science? He was a dentist?
No. You know, as a young man, as a scientist, let me confess with you, we think that everybody else is mad and I alone am a sensible chap. I think you might agree with me. As a scientist, we all feel, or as a growing young man, we all feel that I am the only normal chap and rest everybody seems to be a fool. And there are millions of people following Swami. And I thought they are all a bunch of fools, you know.
You know, people, sheeple, mob
yes,
psychology.
Absolutely.
So how did the first visit to Puttaparthi happen and what was it like?
I soon requested my mother to come along. We both visited Puttaparthi.
From Chennai?
From Chennai, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It was a night bus, you
mm-hmm.
know. In those days, we took get down at Dharmavaram and
yes.
then take another bus, you
yeah.
know. I vaguely remember. Anyway, so I reached here. I was amidst those 5,000-10,000 people sitting here. In those days, Purnachandra Hall had not come up. Kulwant Hall was not. I'm sorry, Kulwant Hall was not there.
Kulwant Hall had not come.
Kulwant Hall
PC auditorium was there.
Punchandra was there.
Yes.
Punchandra was there.
Yeah.
But Kulwant Hall wasn't
we
there.
We sat for darshan in the open.
Open, mm-hmm. yeah, on the sands.
Yes.
So we sat down. There was an elderly gentleman by my side, an Englishman, who observed that I seemed to be a first-time visitor. Because I was not even keeping my hands folded when Swami came in, you know. So he nudged me a message that he's God, you know, fold your hands. So, out of courtesy, I also did that. Then, you know, I could converse with him. So, I asked him, what is this people extending letters to Swami, you know? So, he says, you also write anything.
Mm-hmm.
If Swami takes it or blesses you, your wish will be granted.
Mm-hmm.
So, I considered it to be sort of a fairy tale going on. And people all kind of like a herd of sheep hypnotized into believing him to be God. So, anyway, if that be so, I am also here. Let me also kind of play the game, as everyone else is doing.
Mm-hmm.
They seem to be doing out of some abnormal belief, but I was curious, inquisitive. So, he gave me a piece of paper, tore a piece of paper, sort of a newspaper bit. I looked at him as if that this doesn't look to be all right. He says, no, he is God, don't get formal. Oh, very well. So, I thought I'll write something. Ask Swami, is God, and suppose he is. So my first letter was, if you are God.
Okay.
And now began my...
wish list?
My list, you know, thinking, what should I ask for? Because I can't ask for an endless list.
Mm-hmm.
I have to ask for something which is most prominent in my mind.
Mm-hmm.
And he had already started walking down the aisle.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew that he would reach me in 1-3 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to quickly decide what to write. Should I ask for a Merc or a BMW? Or should I ask for a big house? Or should I ask for a super speciality?
Mm-hmm.
I was those days a surgeon.
Mm-hmm.
And super speciality was very high on my mind that should I ask for oncology or GI surgery or what surgery do I want to do? But I had to quickly decide, you know. And without my knowing it, without my knowing the reason for it, I wrote down, if you're God, it, which I'd already written, please give me peace.
The Mercedes and the BMW fell by the way.
And I just wrote down, you give me peace. Not that I was evidently, obviously lacking any peace. Not that I had ever thought about this concept of peace. But I wrote down, if you are God, give me peace. Swami was quite away from me because I was deep down in the crowd. So there's no way I could have handed him over the chit, you know. But he looked at me for a second or so and blessed me.
By raising his hand?
By raising his hand. And I felt that he conveyed to me that there is no greater gift that he has within his treasure chest.
Than the one you'd asked for.
One had asked for. And he smiled and gave me a knowing smile as if there couldn't have been anything greater that you asked for in the first visit
but
of yours.
The letter remained with you.
The letter remained with me. The letter remained with me and he said that there can't be anything pricier than what you asked on your first visit. But anyway, I brushed that aside. I thought this is all a hypnotism game going on. So he's trying to hypnotize me also. So I didn't want to be hypnotized. I kept away. And I put that thing in my pocket and then threw it away. And that's what the first visit was really. But the magic happened that from that moment, I started as if floating in the air, you know. My feet wouldn't touch the ground.
Some inner happiness? You grew wings?
I was like, I grew wings. And that was not momentary. That lasted for a fortnight, even after reaching back Chennai. To the extent that my colleagues and friends started pointing out that something has happened to you. You're not the same person. You're not the same surgeon. My operating room assistants pointed out, the nursing officers pointed out, that you don't shout around. You don't throw away instruments in anger. You are not the same person. And I also felt that my feet are not touching the ground. I don't need my drinks. I don't need my smoking. I don't need the things which I was so heavily into. I'm as such light and enjoying myself. That was the feeling which stayed with me for a fortnight. And within that fortnight, with a lot of introspection that he has hypnotized me, came the very, very beatifying, very blessed thought that it is a welcome hypnotism. Let me call it hypnotism for want of a better word, because I don't know another word. Let me say it is hypnotism, but don't I want to be hypnotized?
You love being under the spell.
I want it.
Welcome but spell, huh?
I was trying to get this from all the drinks which I was immersed into. We started drinking right from my college days, and that's the society many of us are brought up in. So the drinks were always falling short and one could never feel that high, you know. Even at the end of half a bottle of whiskey, I never felt that high. And all those cigarettes and all those other things medical graduates get into, you know, without naming them. So I had never felt that happy. And I started craving for that hypnotism. That's the word that I knew at that time, mesmerism, hypnotism, for which people had been always cautioning, you know, that stay away from these men, they can hypnotize you. So I felt that, yes, he has hypnotized me, but let me get more and more hypnotized. And in a fortnight's time, I went to General Verma, Colonel Verma at that time, and I said, sir, I want some leave, I want to go to Puttaparthi again. He did ask me that last fortnight you'd been, I had been as a, you know, as an inquirer out of curiosity. Now something seems to be happening within me and I want to go and taste it better all over again. But he said, very fine. You have your leave, entitled leave, and you can take as many days as you want. So that's when I took about a week's leave. And I was here in Puttaparthi back again in a fortnight's time. That was alone. Alone. I really wanted to taste it now.
How did that go?
Oh, that was fantastic. Wonderful. In the first day only, Swami again blessed me from a distance. And he talked to me again from a distance, aerial, spirit to spirit, heart to heart. And he told me, don't begin on an exercise of exploring me. I don't want you to advertise me. I can be the least affected if you call me a magician or a human. It doesn't affect me at all. What matters to me and to you is that what do you know about yourself and does it enhance you or not? If you can know yourself, then rest assured that you'll start having glimpses of me also. But that's even not important. To have glimpses of me is not important. To have glimpses of yourself is more important because that's going to elevate you. And yes, the second thing is that I have put you on the Mount Everest. Yes.
That meaning what?
Meaning that I did raise your consciousness for this 15 days. You call it hypnotism or mesmerism, call it whatever. I have definitely raised you to the level of Mount Everest.
Okay.
Now you have come here for what? You have come here to ask me to keep you there. Now let me tell you, I'll not keep you there. You will keep yourselves there.
Now, how
now
did you
begins
receive?
Your effort. Oh. Now, all this was happening heart to heart.
Okay.
I was just sitting in the darshans and he was sitting in front.
And you were hearing
there was
this
no,
from within?
There was no talk going on.
No physical contact?
No physical contact.
Except you could see him?
I could see him. I could see him and I could feel all that happening within me. That, you see, take me as a teacher, and a teacher is a must. For you to be a surgeon also, you had required a teacher. To know how to live, you require a teacher. And I am that teacher, and this is what is called a guru. I'll teach you how to live, how to think, how to perceive, how to talk, how to relate yourselves with others, and how to relate yourselves with yourself. And that will evolve you. I said, I mean, how would I learn all that? He says, I have not come to teach anything new. Absolutely nothing new. It is just that your Vedanta and your Qurans and your Bhagavad Gita and your Ramayans, you had never tried to understand. And even if you did try, you required a teacher. I am that teacher who will make you understand your own religion, your own scriptures, and that will keep you at that level which you presently seem to be in. And I became a serious student of Swami. Such a serious student that all my annual leaves, as an army officer, we get 2 months annual leaves and about 20 days of casual leave. All my annual leaves and casual leaves were spent in Puttaparthi. And so much so that people here identified me as Swami's student because, you know, I looked like that. And I was often here. So they thought and they asked me, are you Swami student? And I also started from my heart saying, yes, I'm a Swami student because I'm actually a student.
You were learning.
I was learning.
Very interesting. So thus began your journey of self-inquiry.
Absolutely.
Know thyself.
I got
who
obsessed
am I?
About it. Yes. I got obsessed about it. I read about be it Vedanta or be it Bhagavad Gita or be it Swami's Vahinis basically. You know, I always used to call that all the books which are available in the bookstores are generally magazines of Swami. The books written by us devotees on Swami. But if one really wants to read what Swami himself says, it has to be Vahinis.
Yeah, it has to be from the source.
Vahini, from the source.
And Vahinis and the Satyasai speaks. And a lot of people go for the entertainment and
yes.
the experiences. But
yes.
if you really want to be a true student, you have to go back to the source.
Absolutely.
That's
yes.
the most organic
yes.
nourishment.
So I immersed myself into Vahinis.
Mm-hmm.
And the most interesting thing was that the right book used to be in my hands. I mean, a book which I could understand. Initial days, you can't understand very heavy text, you know. So very easy books used to come to my hand those days. And then as I grew better and better, deeper and deeper texts used to come to my hands.
Now, shortly after this, you were at the Tata Memorial Hospital studying oncology.
I was doing fellowship in oncosurgery in Tata Hospital from
in 96, Bombay.
Yeah, from 96 to 98, yeah.
And there was quite a turning point again in your life
oh,
there.
Oh, yes, because I had become abnormally obsessed about this seeking, you know, seeking under the umbrella of Swami. So it appeared that Swami has made me abnormal. Although it was the self-seeking which had made me look abnormal for people, you know. People identified me to be something having gone wrong, you know, inside. So
why? Was your behavior any odd?
Oh, yes. I became too much of an introvert. And I would interact much lesser because I was immersed in studies, you know. As an I used to recall that my mother used to tell me that when you were doing your MS, there was beautiful flowers along the aisle from my room to her room.
Mm-hmm.
And I had never noticed those flowers ever till the day I passed MS. And I said, oh, what beautiful dahlias and pansies and beautiful flowers are growing on the side. She said that this was there for the last 2 years. You never noticed them. Yes, it happens, you know, when you get obsessed about something. The mind is very peculiar, as Swami tells us, that can focus at one thing at a time. It cannot focus at a million things at a time. If I'm looking at you, I'm only looking at you. I can't look at the bottle also. So I was concentrating on this self-seeking, on the Swami's teachings, and of course on Swami, yes.
Mm-hmm.
So the quest had become so obsessive that I needed nothing else but reaching the goal, you know.
So you were longing, pining.
Longing, pining. It had reached the pinnacle on one fine day when everything happened, you know.
Now tell us about it. What was that experience like? You were sharing your dormitory with some others?
I was. We were three people, three doctors sharing a dormitory. Since meeting Swami, I started getting up at 5 in the morning and beginning some meditation, whatever way I at that time comprehended, or reading Vahini. And then this time became earlier and earlier and earlier, and it came down to 3 o'clock, 2:30 also. So I would sleep early and I would get up very early. I would sleep early because I wanted to get up early.
But as a surgeon, didn't you have night duties?
No, that was, the work was never coming in the way. Work was getting even better, better, better. Because, I don't know, when there's inner peace, you know, the efficiency increases. It's logical, it's scientific. When there is inner peace, efficiency always keeps rising. And if I am dying to do a work better and better, I may not be able to do it as well. But if there's inner quiet, that work itself gets better. And particularly so in a subject like surgery, where your stability of mind and hands is paramount. Without my wanting, it started happening in a magical way. Hands started moving like a magician. Without my wanting to train them, they started, you know, moving beautifully. Everybody started commenting that what has happened, you know. Kind of something uncanny about the hand movements. And my surgical videos on the net also, they invite a lot of correspondence and people do ask me about the trick behind the hand movements.
What do you tell them?
I tell them it's from the right hemisphere, it's not from the left hemisphere. So some people do understand, some people find it a bit esoteric. And I do tell them that, you see, it's the left hemisphere which believes in logic and intellect. It's the right hemisphere of our brains, which is about emotions and about inner peace, you know. So if you reach a state of inner peace, things start working like magic. Everything, in fact, in life, not just about surgery. Everything in life, your relationships, profession, anything and everything starts working amazingly beautiful if you reach that state of inner peace. So we were talking about the Tata Memorial days, you know. So I had reached that state where the pining had reached its crescendo. That morning, it was the 2nd of July, 1996, I can never forget that. 4 o'clock in the morning, I was in that state of pining because I couldn't get sleep also those days. The pining was so much. So what happens? I feel Swami had appeared before me in body because I felt that I could feel his robe. I felt that I could feel his hand on my head. And I could as if hold him in my arms and hands. You know.
Were your eyes open or closed?
My eyes were open, very much open. Yet, if somebody says that if others could also see him, no. Had others been around or awake, they were sleeping by the way, but if they had been, they wouldn't have felt him because he was more real than body, yet I would say he was not the body. He was not really physically there because the date could not be forgotten. It changed my life, it changed my outlook, it changed everything about me.
Did you communicate?
From that day.
I did
talk to Swami because he was there. So I could talk to him, I could relate with him, and he also talked with me. He did ask me, what do you want?
In what language?
If you ask me, I would not be able to say it was in Hindi or English, but it was in the language which I was thinking in, you know.
Mm-hmm.
His language is not
the
only
heart,
spoken,
yeah.
It's thought also. We never think without a language.
Mm-hmm.
So I was thinking in that language, whatever, it generally is in English.
Mm.
So I was thinking and he said that, what do you want? And I said, Swami, you've never prepared me for asking for anything. And I've always asked for you only. And you have come. So what can I ask you for? He blessed me. He also said that I should, you know that he has appeared, which I wanted ever, I should take something from him. When I continued to persevere that I don't really know what to ask for, he says that, what do you want? I said, I want only God. I only want you. And you are God. You have appeared before me. So he says, if you want only me, you would be finished. For a while I didn't understand what does it mean. But he elaborated on it. He said, professionally, socially, financially, three aspects which matter to a man, they will all be finished. There will be nothing left about you. I said, Swami, let that be. You seem to have prepared me to say this, yes, you know, not that I can say it on my own. You seem to have given me the strength also to accept that, okay, let me be through, let me be over. You but be with me, please. Keep holding me like this. And he says, so be it. He looked, in fact, serious. He says, so be it. And indeed, he demonstrated to me in the next 2 years, 3 years, from 96 to 99, that everything which is visible to the world, which is visible to me as the physical self, went out of my hands. Everything. But all along, I was floating in the air because Swami was holding me. Not just holding me, it appeared as if I was in his arms, you know.
Now, this experience where you interacted with him in the dormitory, how did it conclude?
It concluded very beautifully. When he said, okay, let that be. Then he says, okay, then I can't fly out of the window or I can't disappear into nothingness. I merge into you and I'll take care of you. And he kind of became vapors which went into my body. This was all very beautiful experiences. They're spiritual experiences. And yes, you did comment that it looks like I had become schizophrenic, which I had been calling him all along. It was that kind of an abnormal feeling, supernormal feeling. Mm-hmm. What people call abnormal, I call it supernormal. Mm-hmm. But let's not call them either ab or super. Let's call them paranormal. They are not comprehensible to the normal existence, you know. Mm-hmm.
Now then, when Swami spoke to you about these three zeros we often hear, he says,
yes,
you know, you're going to lose everything financially, socially, professionally. What happened?
Really, for those 3 years, it was like a vanvas, you know. It was like everything flying out of my hands. Socially, financially, professionally, I became, so to say, a non-entity. I, as if, was not existing.
But did you suffer a series of setbacks?
Setbacks, as far as, yes, my mother's terminology,
mm-hmm.
She was very worried that what is happening. She would go to pandits and jyotishis to get some solutions about what is, you know, bad period in my son's life.
So you went
why everything
series.
Is series and series of everything seemingly going against me. I would again and again say seemingly because within my heart I was
so happy.
I was so very happy.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing was happening to me.
Mm-hmm.
To the point, to the extent that there were sometimes tears rolling down in streams down the cheeks. And tears of such pain that I would pick some tears on my finger and see whether they are red or they are white. Is it blood or is it actual tears? I mean, the tears of that kind of a pain.
But was this the
mental,
pain for your disappointments or?
No, really. I was still very, very happy. Well, it's an abnormal
What were you
state.
Aching for? The agony was for Baba?
No, there was no agony. There was no agony after that. Baba was with me.
Mm-hmm. So why were you crying then?
You see, when everything was going topsy-turvy,
mm-hmm.
in my family life, mm-hmm. in my professional life, mm-hmm. in my financial aspects, when everything was going out of hands, sometimes there was situations that there was unbearable pain, but in that unbearable pain also, I felt that I was extremely happy. I was enjoying it. just to give you an example, unrelated, you know, as they say, suffering is optional, pain is inevitable in life. So that means pain and suffering are two different dimensions. Pain can come, but suffer or not to suffer is in your hands. So when God is with you, you can't suffer. I was never suffering. But yes, there were moments when I was actually in pain, physical, mental, deep down pain in the heart, when things were going out of my hands and I wanted that this should not happen to me. So I was in pain, yet, but I was never suffering, you know. I was never suffering. In a lighter mood, I would share with you that once I had a catch in the back. I was riveted to the ground. I couldn't move an inch, you know, when the disc kind of nudges on the nerves. Mm. You can't move an inch when severe catch in the back. My mother was worrying by my bedside and she was trying to hold my hand and comfort me, and I was trying to tell her that I'm enjoying myself, I'm very happy. She said, if you're so happy, then show me a movement. Oh, I said, I can't move, but I'm very happy. So she would not understand. She says, what is this happiness? You can't move an inch and you say, I'm very happy. No, I said, I can't make you understand, but I'm very happy. Now that happiness comes in a state of spiritual elevation, enlightenment, realization, call it whatever words. So with Swami having merged molecule to molecule within, it kept me in a state of, you know, feet wouldn't touch the ground, my body as if was levitated. I've always been living like that for now about, say, 17 odd years since 96.
And with, obviously, you came out of that difficult situation, whatever.
Oh,
just...
yes, he has been giving me visions, he's been telling me about future, you know. In 99, he told me, now that you have withstood the tests and you want only me, and wherever I live, the creator of this universe, how can there be any deficiency there? Mm-hmm. Now everything is going to come around you, be it financial, be it professional, be it social, you will be fulfilled. Mm-hmm. And yes, I found that everything started changing. I became again a sought after oncosurgeon. My family life became straightened. Financially, everything started pouring in, and I became visibly full and filled. Earlier, I was full and filled from within only, and since 99, everything took a change, you know.
That's incredibly interesting to know. Every time Bhagwan communicates with you, I understand all this deep communication that you experience with Bhagwan has nothing to do with his physical form.
Not really. Physically, Swami has allowed me to touch him only a counted few times. Mm-hmm. Yes, I've had the good fortune of being physically at his feet for more than a minute once. Mm-hmm. And a few seconds a couple of times. Mm-hmm. Indeed, I've had. And yes, I've had received some vibhuti from him once, twice, thrice. And they've all been evidences that, yes, I'm with you. And not that it was only that vision in my Tata Memorial mm-hmm. room. He proved it also in Puttaparthi. He told me while he was merging back into me mm-hmm. at my room in Tata Memorial, he told me in a month's time you will come to Puttaparthi and I'll give you a proof that I had come to your room. Mm-hmm. He did tell me. And yes, within that July on the 30th, I happened to be here. And this is where Swami proved that yes, he had come to my room.
So today, as you head a very significant section of medical care, the oncology surgeries, how does Swami play a role in what you do and how you do it?
Me as a person, what Swami has trained me like, what he has brought me up like as a son, is that I should be absolutely, truly, completely, 100% surrendered to him and his will. I am 100% surrendered to him by his grace. As a manifestation of that surrender, I see miracles every moment. Not that I want everything to go tickety-boo, but I may confess that everything is going wonderfully, beautifully. Be it my surgeries, be it my running the department, be it as an officer in the Indian Army. yeah, there is one thing which keeps irking me. That is my inability to socialize in the party life, which is necessary part of the army life, which amazingly people have been forgiving me for that. I'm unable to hold a glass and, you know, socialize the parties the way it is expected.
Yeah,
because I don't drink. It's a part of
the culture.
I don't drink and I avoid a bit too much of talking. I stay in the bliss which Swami keeps me in. Involve myself with the efficiency of the department, that's about it. And otherwise social relationships, which deals with helping anyone whom I can, as Swami teaches us. But I'm unable to socialize the way the army parties expect us to do. That's the only thing which I would say amiss, and not going with the stream, you know. Otherwise, I'm just like anybody else.
Does it affect your relationship with your peers? Or does it bother you how they evaluate you because you are socially out of place in that culture?
Not that it bothers me ever, because Swami, the way he stays with me, he's blessed me with a special blessing that, yeah, I permit you to stay the way you are. You don't have to change, bend rules of your own conscience, and you live the way you are. Mm-hmm. I'll take care of you. And he gives me such unmistakable signs that I am like I am, and all my seniors and colleagues and peers, they accept me as I am.
Now, you spoke of being in a state of surrender. Would you care to explain what that means for a person who has to make so many decisions, conscious decisions, as a head of a department and someone who is dealing with life and death situation moment to moment?
It is quite logical, or I would say scientific, to say that we must focus on what is in my hands and do it effectively and efficiently and sincerely. And whatever be the result, consider it to be holy and His will. Isn't it logical and scientific and perhaps a wiser way of living, even if one uses common sense and nothing about spirituality? So this is what surrender is about. Do your work well, efficiently, happily, lovefully, sincerely. And whatever be the result, know it to be success, rather than evaluating it and saying that it is a failure this time and a success next time. Whatever happens, I consider it to be a success. Now, if you ask me how are the results of the surgery, I would say 99% they are actually, in the physical sense also, they are amazingly successful or wonderful. But we have already accepted that whatever be the result, we will call it success in a spiritual way, in a wiser way. Whatever happens, if I was to come here to Puttaparthi and I was told that there are not going to be lights and not going to be any water, that's Swami's will. It is wonderful. We are enjoying it. Rather than saying, oh, why there is no light? Why there is no water? How would we live? And that I attributed to my wife, that she is equally as much with me. And I from her heart know that she is also not resenting that we seemingly appear to be uncomfortable. Like the children tell us that there is no light, they are uncomfortable. They also beautifully don't really air it. They may be having it in their heart. They also enjoying themselves, in fact. So, I mean, surrender means that whatever is happening is wonderfully, amazingly good.
Now, your life's journey is very interesting. You come from a background of science and agnosticism, and then you went through this process of what may be described as breaking everything apart and starting from bottom up all the way. And we've read such stories in the biographies of saints and sages of the past. Now, you're a professional person living in 21st century India in the national capital. You see lots of political drama happening around you in a country where there's serious law and order issues. Where do you see everything going from the place that you are? You seem to be in a totally different sphere where everything is God-driven, God-led, God-determined, God-surrendered. And then there is another narrative going on the side, but there's so much of disparity, corruption, lawlessness, dishonesty. How do you reconcile these two narratives happening in your life? You don't live in isolation, in your own bubble, within your head. Obviously, you're experiencing this continuous communication with Swami, as you say. But around you, things are not similar. The temperature and the climate around you is very different.
Yeah, you're very right. But you see, as we learn from the science called spirituality, And as we evolve as human beings within the sphere of science, we realize that the mind can only focus on one thing. If the mind is obsessed and focused about love, efficiency, bliss, sincerity, it can't focus on the other aspect of life which you happen to touch about, that what all is happening around the world, you know, seemingly happening. To me, it appears that my job is to stay focused on what I should be doing.
But you can't live in isolation, you're part of society.
If I can mind my own business, everything falls into shape. If all of us start minding our own business, there will be peace and tranquility all around. So if I can only sort out my sphere where I have a control over, I think that's what concerns me, and I concern myself with looking after whatever is within my hands and not extending my influence over to national and international subjects and aspects of life which I have no control over. I don't really waste my time in thinking what Mr. Manmohan Singh Ji should be doing. Because it is, I think, a wastage of my time. My thinking about what he should be doing is a waste of time. He should be thinking what he should be doing. And if I ever happen to be, if God's will be that I am on the other side of the table, then I should be thinking at that time what I can be doing, rather than presently thinking what I should be doing. Or if I waste my time in thinking what my director general should be doing, I think that's also wasting my time. I should only focus my attention on what I should do to a particular patient who I'm going to handle tomorrow, or what I should be doing as the head of the department. And that's what I really concern myself with.
Mm-hmm. Now, as a society, are we not large organism? And if one cell is ailing, you're a doctor, if one cell decides to mutate, it can affect a larger group of cells?
Indeed, and if one cell mutates into a blissful state of being, mm-hmm. then also I can have a huge impact on my surroundings. And that's what I think I am being able to be utilized as a tool in Swami's hands.
Nice perspective.
That I keep myself happy, comfortable, cheerful, and that definitely has an impact on my family, my neighbors, in my workplace, and wherever I move around.
Very nice perspective, Doc. Now, from where you are, the place, the space that you are at as a person in your own evolution, where do you see the future of humanity headed?
Oh, I think there was no profounder a scientist as Darwin was, mm-hmm. who was such a firm believer of evolution. And I think every one of us is evolving. All this corruption, all this suffering is all evolving. All of us are evolving into blissful, beneficent human beings. Peaceful, beneficent, sincere human beings. It's only a matter of time. If I could evolve into what I am presently, and I consider it to be evolution, and we are persistently, constantly evolving, I'm also evolving, you're also evolving. And what do I mean by evolution? Is ever at peace within myself, ever at peace with my surroundings. If I can be, and if everyone can be, and I'm sure everyone is going to be in its own time. Not that everything happens at one time with everybody at one time. It'll be in each individual's life, it will come about. It will come about today or tomorrow.
It's a personal process for each person.
It's a personal process. All that everybody is suffering is because we don't want to finally suffer.
Mm-hmm.
It's just happening temporarily, presently. And tomorrow it should not be happening if we are consciously living.
The golden age, people talk of the shift happening in consciousness. What's your take on that?
I think it's imaginary. I think, if I may say so, I don't want to make a statement, but I think it's happening for everybody. A golden age, when it happens within me, I find everything golden. I don't find that we are living in a Kali Yuga. I think we are living in a Satyuga, because I live in a Satyuga. So it's imperative for every individual to create a Satyuga for himself, and then there will be everything fine with him, around him. Nobody will come and fight with him. When I'm at peace, nobody really fights with me.
You don't have disagreements with your colleagues.
Look at this. You see, between me and my wife, we never even have a discussion which is loud.
Well, what if you speak as softly as you do, it's very unlikely it will happen.
It never happens. I mean, not that whatever she thinks in her heart, I perceive it and I do it. And whatever I think in my heart, she does it, we never have an argument. And so is the state with my children also. Between me and my children, not that my wife and children don't fight with each other. They do. But with me, nobody fights. In my workplace, in my house, and between me and my neighbors, there's never a fight.
Let's say your superiors decide on a policy matter you don't agree with and you don't see the worth of it and you feel maybe a different policy might be more beneficial to the work that you do. How would you resolve that?
You see, in the army life, I would share with you, if an order is given to me, it's a lawful order, I must say, yes, sir, it'll be done.
No insubordination, no room for that.
Never, never. But then there is a conscience also, the conscience whom we call God, whom we call Swami. The conscience within me tells me that it's not supposed to be done like this. I will give it its time and then go and apologize that I'm very sorry. It wasn't possible for me to do this. Please excuse me if you can. And if you think that no, I have failed in carrying out your instructions, then of course you should punish me the way the best you feel. I am ready for that. So I finally get down to doing whatever my conscience permits me to do. But I never outrightly say no to anything which I am, as a man of the society, not supposed to be doing.
Have you got yourself into trouble for this ever?
Never.
How do your superiors respond? They see your point
of
view?
They seem to see through my paranormal existence. They like me, they appreciate me, and so far I've always been appreciated wherever I have been. And I attribute it to, from my heart, to Swami's blessings. The mind and the body can never adequately express this, but every moment, every breath of mine is Swami's blessings.
They are for all of us, but I guess you are in a state of awareness.
I once asked Swami that you are supposed to be an impartial God. How is it that you are always with me and not with everybody else? He says it is because you need me, others don't need me. Anybody who needs me, I'll be with him as much. It is our need for him. As he says, you don't have to deserve me, you have to desire me. So we are, none of us can deserve God, but we can all desire God. And that's the time in each one of our life. Time comes when we say, I desire God and nothing more and nothing else. And the day we say, I desire God and not the toys from his hands, then he becomes ours really. And that's a very beautiful scientific or metaphysical happening. It can happen in to anybody's life if we truly come to a point when we say that I just need you and nothing else. And I look at Swami as one form of God who has come to us as Krishna also, and Jesus also, and Rama also, anybody.
Well, Dr. Talwar, it's been amazing listening to your bliss experiment. Your life sounds like a big bliss experiment, and
yes,
a lot of learning just listening
yes
to you. Thank you so very much.
Thank you very much.
Great having you on the show. Sai Ram.
Sai Ram.
Sai Ram, dear listeners, and welcome back to Morning Glory, coming to you live from Prashanthi Nilayam, India, the seat of all things true, beautiful and auspicious. Today is the 7th of November 2013, and the time right now in Prashanthi Nilayam is 10:30 a.m. You just heard a Triswit Divinity interview with the New Delhi-based oncosurgeon, Dr. Rajneesh Talwar. Did you find it useful? Please share your feedback with us through email. You can reach us, as always, at listener@radiosai.org. Now, before we go any further, let me remind all our listeners of all ages that the month of November has begun, and so has the countdown to the birthday celebrations of our beloved Bhagwan. Every devotee and every Sai worker, every Sai child and every Sai youth is now thinking, what can I do for Baba's birthday? What is it that will make him happy? If Swami ever expected anything from us, for all that he has done and continues to do for us, it is simply this, to be happy. So brothers and sisters, this is what we at Radio Sai want you to focus on as we herald the 88th birthday of our Swami. Ask yourself the question, what is the one change that I will bring in my life from this birthday that will add happiness to my life and make my Swami proud? We want you to answer this question and send us your resolves and resolutions, promises and pledges. That determined shift in your life from November 23rd towards a more empowered and enlightened life is what we are looking for. You can send us your resolution or your pledge in any of the following formats. If it's a text, let it not be more than 300 words. If it's an audio clip, let the maximum duration be 3 minutes. If you'd prefer an audio clip, the way you can listen to it, because audio clips have a certain intensity, so that's definitely our preference one. Now you can also send us a video clip. That would be an ideal thing. If you're sending us a video, do send us a photograph of yours, along with, of course, your name, city and country. And as always, write to us at h2h@radiosci.org. I'll repeat the email ID for this submission, h2h@radiosci.org. H2H, of course, stands for heart to heart. And in the subject line, you write, my birthday offering. And you can start submitting your entries right now. Now, what are we going to do with these entries? You may be wondering. We're going to post these entries on our website, play them on Radio Sai. And most importantly, on the morning of beloved Bhagavan's birthday on November 23rd, we will offer these at the Mahasamadhi in the form of a beautiful Radio Sai birthday card. So you'll be part of the team making an offering there. And if you wish to learn more about this contest, what am I doing for Bhagwan's birthday, you can check our homepage, radiosci.org, or our Facebook page, facebook.com/radiosci. So we are really looking forward to tons of entries from our listeners all over the world, young and not so young, and the young at heart, all included. Moving along, up next on Morning Glory, part one of a brand new episode of Fleeting Moments, Lasting Memories with Sai University alumnus, Mr. Gautam Dutt. This is a multiple part interview and you can catch it all by tuning to Morning Glory every Thursday, where we'll play it for you over the next several weeks. Over now to Brother Gautam Dutt in conversation with Radio Sai's Mr. Bishu Prushti.
Sairam, dear listeners, and welcome to Fleeting Moments, Lasting Memories, our series of conversations on Radio Sai with former students of Bhagwan's educational institutions. And today, I have someone who has had the opportunity to stay at Bhagwan's lotus feet and bask in his physical proximity for nearly two decades. First 5 years as a student and the rest as a faculty member in his university, Mr. Gautam Dutt. This name might ring a bell in some of you who have been following this series. Yes, he is the brother of Mr. Bharat Dutt, who was here in Radio Sai probably a year or two ago, sometime in 2011. And that was an enriching conversation, many of you would agree. And today, thanks to Bhagwan's grace, thanks to divine design, we have Mr. Gautam Dutt with us. His family hails from Punjab and it's an immensely blessed family. In fact, Swami brought them to his fold in 1979-1980, and from 1985, the parents of the Dutt brothers have been living inside the ashram, and they continue to do so even today. What I have heard, and I do know, is that in those early years of their relationship with Bhagwan, Swami showered his love on them graciously and copiously. I was not in Prashanti then to witness those days, but I was fortunate to have Mr. Dutt as my English teacher during my student days in the Vrindavan campus. So it's really heartening and humbling to sit in front of Sir today as an interviewer. I hope he approves my English, my language, my pronunciation, diction and so on. So with gratitude to Swami, we begin this conversation. And before we get started, let me just mention the exact details of Mr. Dutt's stay in Prashanthi Nilayam so that you get a proper perspective as he starts to narrate his stories. He joined the Prashanthi Nilayam campus of Bhagwan's University in 1984 for his BA, Bachelor's in Arts, and he went on to do his Master's in Arts, MA in English, which he completed in 1989. Immediately after this, Bhagwan graced him with the opportunity of teaching in his college in the Vrindavan campus, which he did for 14 years till 2003. Later, he moved to the Middle East, to the Gulf country of Sultanate of Oman, where he currently resides, working as head of the Department of English in Caledonian College of Engineering. So with great pleasure, I welcome you, sir, to the studios of Radio Sai.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here. And I pray to Swami that I'm able to convey His mahimas.
Yes.
As best as I can.
Yes, we really want to hear those mahimas, those fleeting moments, as this series is called, which have become your eternal memories. And I think it is through these moments, all of us can learn about Bhagwan. There is this section of the current generation who has had the opportunity of spending time with the physical presence of the avatar. And those of us who have had that chance, I think it is our great good fortune to share those moments so that all of us can document this as well as learn from this. And these are lessons I always believe for lifetimes and for generations to come. So please go on, share how this relationship with Bhagwan began.
Well, actually, I totally agree with you. In fact, I keep telling the devotees back in the Gulf that the only treasure that we as students who have interacted with Baba have is the interaction with Bhagwan. You know,
yes.
That's the only treasure we have, and that's the only treasure I have to share with the world. So your question was, how did my journey to the Divine Lotus Feet begin?
Yes.
Well, Baba says very, very sweetly, the mother, you know, is a very important member of the family. She is the one who usually guides us, and therefore it was my mother who actually led us to the Divine Lotus Feet. It was in Udhampur. My father was in the army and he was posted there.
Udhampur is in the state of
Kashmir.
Kashmir.
It was the headquarters of the Northern Command at that time.
Okay.
General Malhotra was an ardent devotee of Baba.
Yes, and he was familiar figure in Prashant.
Yes, and he was the Commander-in-Chief of the Northern Command at that time. So there used to be a small group of devotees there who used to do bhajans. And, you know, being a mother who had two sons, who were very wayward, I must add, as all sons are at that age, I think, especially in the teenage years, she was always worried about, you know, about our future and, you know, about our well-being.
How old were you then?
I was in school.
School.
At that time. High school, actually. And my brother must have been, he's 5 years younger to me, so okay. he was 5 years younger. And she was always worried. So, you know, she would always be looking for some kind of confirmation that our future would be bright and it would be good, and as all mothers do. And she came to know about these bhajans which were being held. And being a religious person herself, she started attending these bhajans. And she started hearing about Bhagwan. And then it became a regular feature. You know, every Thursday she would go for these bhajans. At that time, neither my father nor my brother nor me were very concerned about, you know, who Baba was. We didn't even know anything. And then slowly, you know, she got a picture of Baba and kept it by her bedside. And I remember Baba used to shower or sprinkle Amritam on that picture.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, we used to be surprised and everything, but, you know, it never struck us as something extraordinary because we were not into...
So it was something between your mother and that photograph. Baba. You didn't really want to think much about it.
Yeah, we were happy because my mother was happy, you know.
Okay.
And she would say, and of course devotees would come, those small group of devotees, and they would all, you know, be very happy and blissful and all that. And we watched all this, but it was very objectively, you know,
yeah.
Not involved in it. And then it was in the year 1980 that Baba's birthday came around. And this time my mother was a little firm. She said, look, all of you have to attend the Akhand Bhajan. There was an Akhand Bhajan for Baba's birthday at the home of one of the devotees. And she said, you have to attend. So she made a concession. She said, the last few hours, you know, a couple of hours, you must come and attend the bhajan and then have the prasadam and then leave. My father had, of course, no choice because my mother said, and he really dallied, but he finally agreed. He tried to say, I've got some work and all, but nothing worked and he had to agree. My brother was too small to disagree. I was the only one, you know, who, being a teenager, she had to convince me. So I remember she came to my room and when I look back, I really laugh. I was a lot into music. I used to love music.
Okay.
So this Western music was playing in my room, I remember. I had my own room. She came and she sat down and she spoke to me very nicely and she said, will you do something for me? And I said, of course I'll do, tell me what it is. I'll do whatever you want. And she said, come and attend the bhajan. And, you know, I was kind of, I turned to her and I said things like, oh, come on, mother, it'll be very boring. How can a young man like me, you know, attend bhajans? And, you know, how can I sit there for 1 hour and stuff like that? And finally, you know, she said, no, no, just do it for my sake. And I said, okay, for your sake, I will come, but on one condition. The car keys will be with me.
Oh.
If I am bored, I will get up and I'll leave the bhajan. And you shouldn't mind that. So she said, okay, no problem. At least she got me to agree to come to the bhajan. So there we were, the whole family. We went for bhajan in the house of one retired colonel, Colonel Ratan, whose children also studied in Baba's school. And when I went there, I still remember there was a huge congregation in a hall, and ladies on one side, gents on one side. There were many pictures, you know. Of course, I knew who Baba was, but there were other saints and, you know, gods whose pictures were there. I didn't know who was who. I was not a very religious person, though I used to accompany my mother to the temple whenever she went. I sat down for the bhajan. I was very conscious. Everybody was singing, but, you know, I was conscious. I felt, oh, everybody's watching me, you know, if I sing and all, whether I sing in tune or I don't sing in tune. So I didn't sing. I sat there quietly, but slowly I started singing the bhajans.
Quite unconsciously.
Yeah, quite unconsciously. Actually, what happened is when I sat down, after about 20 minutes or so, a great feeling of peace, you know, settled on me.
Mm-hmm.
And this was a very strange feeling. I'd never felt this kind of feeling before. So I got so immersed in that feeling of this great peace which descended upon me that I forgot the time. And before I knew it, I had sat for about 2.5 hours.
2.5 hours?
Yeah. And the aarti began, you know. And I was surprised myself. I said, oh my God, I've sat through the whole thing. But really, it was blissful. I had this experience of extreme peace, which I'd never experienced before. And I was moved. So anyway, nobody said anything about it when we came back. We came back because everybody was in a joyful mood. The next Thursday, my mother was very surprised because I used to be very particular about a particular sport. I was a very good rider, horse rider.
Okay.
So I used to do a lot of riding, and every evening I used to go for riding, and nothing could break that. I used to love riding. That Thursday, my mother was surprised because I was bathed, I was ready, and I was waiting for her to go to bhajan. And when she stepped out to go
so
to bhajan...
So you're giving up your horse riding for bhajans?
Not that, for that moment, I think for my parents that was a big surprise. And when my mother stepped out to go to bhajan, there I was standing in the veranda and I said, can I come with you? And she was surprised, you know. Till today she says I was so surprised. And I think that's where my journey began. I started attending these bhajans regularly, you know.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, there are so many stories like this. What comes to my mind is one psychiatrist, Alan Levy, you know, from the U.S., who came to Swami again through bhajans. He goes to his brother's house in Newark, and as he steps into his room, Swami's bhajans are on the tape. And he feels so ecstatic listening to Bhagwan's voice on the bhajans that, you know, that's where his journey to Bhagwan starts. So, bhajans in many ways and in so many mysterious ways have pulled Bhagwan.
The holy name of God, you know.
Holy name of God and the power of divine
and
music.
You know, ultimately, look at where Baba led me in just a couple of years. We used to have these Akhand bhajans and we were a small group. So, obviously, doing Akhand bhajans was difficult because, you know, just a group of 5 or 6 people.
Yeah, 24 hours.
Yeah, singing 24 hours. And there used to be a time in the night when many people would get tired and, you know, many people would be sleepy. And I would be the only one singing bhajans all alone throughout the night for hours.
Wow.
So,
and you were someone who was initially so hesitant,
so
to sing.
Reluctant, yes, and you know, saying things like, "I'm a youngster, and you know, how can I go for bhajans?" Yes, yes. That is the power of the Almighty, you know.
Fantastic.
Baba,
you started going for bhajans. So, in some way, the journey to the lotus feet began then.
Yes. That's where it began. Very true. And then, of course, it continued, you know, slowly coming to know about Baba, getting involved in all the activities like Omkaram, Suprabhatam. And then, there came a time when I used to get up at 2 o'clock in the morning.
2 o'clock in the morning?
Yes, you can imagine that in a Kashmir winter, getting up at 2 o'clock in the morning. And then, getting ready. And then doing the Omkaram and Suprabhatam.
I think your parents would have been ecstatic.
I'm sure. I'm sure. My mother would have been very relieved about that. You know. Not that I was a very wayward person, but I was average in studies. I was very good in sports. Mm. So my whole energy was towards sports. I used to participate in a lot of sports. And I was good at it. Mm. So, for example, I used to play cricket for Himachal Pradesh.
Okay, yeah. For the state?
For the state.
Wow.
And I used to represent Haryana for swimming.
Wow.
Yeah, so I was really good at athletics. I was very good at athletics, you know, jog every morning. This was before coming to Baba. And then, so I started getting up at early in the morning and doing all the Suprabhatam and Omkaram and pujas and meditation and, you know, things like that.
Meditation as a teenager.
Yeah, yeah. When I look back, it's really funny. I used to, they had described how to do this Jyotir meditation. So I remember I started with about 2 minutes or 3 minutes of Jyotir meditation. So after doing all my puja and all, I used to sit for this Jyotir meditation just for a few minutes. And it used to be cold. It used to be winter, you know. So the blanket used to be wrapped around me, a blanket. And invariably, even in those 2 or 3 minutes, I used to doze off. I still remember that. That's how I began.
But that enthusiasm was there to do meditation.
Yes.
To get up in the morning and do prayer.
The inspiration, yes. The energy that came from coming into contact with Baba was just amazing. And, you know, once I came into contact with him, he didn't let up.
Yes.
You know, I might have let up. I might have faltered somewhere, but not Baba.
Hmm.
He kept on coming at me, you know, kept on coming at me. In fact, after I came into Baba's fold, just a few months later, I was again sitting in a devotee's house. And, you know, we were talking with Baba. And my mother was talking and the other lady was there and they were talking. And I was sitting quietly, listening. Suddenly, those postcards come with Baba's calendar.
Hmm.
So the lady brought out a calendar with a beautiful picture of Baba. A pocket calendar and said, you should keep one in your pocket with you. And she gave it to me. So, and then she continued talking with my mother. So I took the calendar, I was holding it in my hand and I was looking at it. And then within a few minutes, right in front of my eyes, in the corner of the calendar, something started appearing. And right in front of my eyes, it grew until it became Baba's signature. And it was written, "With love and blessings, Bhagwan Sri Satya Sai Baba."
Oh my God, it just happened in front of your eyes.
It was just in front of my eyes.
In Kashmir?
Yeah, in Kashmir, in Udhampur. And the moment it started happening, I yelled, I said, see what's happening. And then they both came and even the children came and we all saw it just appeared until it became Baba's signature, you know, and I still have that calendar with me.
Absolutely. I mean, I can imagine what sort of an impact it would have had on your mind.
Yeah, and of course, I couldn't believe what was happening. How could this happen, you know? But what I think made me happy was it was written with love and blessings, you know, Bhagwan Sri Satya Sai Baba. So my mother was overjoyed, you know. She said, "Baba's blessed you, Baba's blessed you." And then the message behind it, there was a message behind the calendar with the thing. There was a message, a saying of Baba. God is like a postman.
Oh, wow.
He doesn't know the contents of the letter that he delivers, you know. Because that was the question in my mind. That was what I was struggling with at that point. And that was the answer. Perfect answer.
What was it that was really troubling at that time?
Yeah, why do people have to suffer? Why do people have to, you know, go through all this trouble and tribulation and so on?
All those questions that...
Oh, yeah, those were the questions which were, you know, in my
people
mind.
People start asking once they start knowing about God.
Yes. And the answer was perfect and the timing was perfect, you know.
Yeah.
Later
God
on,
is only a delivery man.
Yeah. At that moment, we only noted the signature. So when we were driving back on the way home, you know, I took it out and I couldn't believe it. So I was looking at it again and again. And then I turned it over and there was this message. So it was such so beautiful. And I said to my mother, I said, "This is exactly the answer to my question."
Wow.
You know, so that was a wonderful experience.
Really awesome.
Yeah.
So strongly, Swami was pulling you into him.
Yeah, I guess, yeah. Because I can't take credit for that. It's always Baba, you know,
yeah,
who pulls you towards him, he attracts you. And he's so compassionate.
Absolutely.
So
in some ways,
undeserving, yeah.
The relationship with him had already, in some ways, sealed. You already had such a sort of strong relationship with him, even before you saw him physically, even before you became a student.
I guess so, because, you know, just
university.
The very reaction which I had when I sat for bhajan, I guess, was soul-fulfilling, is what I call it now. So maybe unconsciously, without knowing it, I was looking for that. You know, one can't say. Maybe consciously I was not aware of it, but unconsciously I was. And when I came into contact with it, I reacted.
Yes.
You know. But definitely, there was one thing, I never questioned his divinity.
Hmm.
You know. Maybe I was fortunate, or some people say sanskar, I don't know what.
Yes.
But I never questioned.
I think there was never an opportunity for this sort of an experience to go to your head. It was always from the heart. Things were happening at the level of the heart.
You're right.
So there was no opportunity for the head to interfere.
Yes. And I was fortunate because of the family in which I was born, I guess.
Yes.
My mother was very religious. My father was very spiritual.
Yes.
I have seen, saints and sages, you know, in northern India.
In northern India.
Who have what we call siddhis and powers.
Yes.
So it didn't seem very strange to me that Baba would be considered as divine. You know?
Yes.
Because I was very familiar with that part of
the holy, holy beings being on earth. And
yeah, of scripture actually. Though I was not pulled or attracted as the way I was until I went for Baba's bhajan. You know? But I was very much aware of it.
Wonderful. So how did it happen from there on that you saw yourself in Bhagwan's university as a student?
Oh, that was a journey. As I say, not from Kashmir to Kanyakumari, but from Kashmir to Puttaparthi.
Yes.
And even when I came here, Baba used to, for a long, long time, he used to call me Udhampur.
Udhampur?
Udhampur,
oh.
Yeah.
Okay.
And he used to always introduce me as, you know, he's from Kashmir.
Mm-hmm.
Udhampur. And I remember one day, General Malhotra had come for Baba's darshan from that place. And he made me stand up and he said, "See, your boy." He said,
"Okay,
how does he look now?" And things like that. And he said, "Baba, you've changed him." And he said, yes. You know.
So a lot of transformation did happen.
Yes. A lot of transformation in a very short time, in fact. What started happening, you know, as I started getting involved with Baba, I started reading about him.
Mm-hmm.
And
So you were now in 8th, 9th or?
No, I was somewhere in my 11th, 12th.
11th, 12th.
Yeah, so I started reading about him. I read Murfitt's
Man of Miracles.
Man of Miracles and several other books. And then I also started reading Baba's discourses,
mm-hmm.
such as I Speaks. And slowly, you know, a kind of desire started developing in me where I wanted to come and study in his university. You know, I wanted to see him, actually.
So it was completely your initiative?
As I said, I can't take credit for it. It was it was something that developed because of, I think, all the sadhana, as we call it, whatever little I did.
Yes.
I think it propelled me towards that. And I started reading.
So it came from you. It was not as if your parents wanted you to study here. You wanted to study.
No. In fact, it's the other way around. My parents got worried when I said I want to study here.
Is it?
Yeah, that's another story. But I'll come to it in the proper time.
Okay.
I started reading about Baba and, you know, my meditation became deeper and deeper. I used to do yoga. And I think because of my proclivity to reading about the scripture and about Baba and so on and doing meditation, it kind of started progressing quite fast. So I think everything pushed me towards that point where I started desiring, you know, that I wanted to see Baba, I wanted to be with Baba, I want to know. I didn't know that Baba had a university by that time.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, the people who were there, from them what I gathered was that Baba had a Ved Pathshala.
Okay.
So I was under the impression that Baba runs a Ved Pathshala, not a university.
Oh, so there is only a Vedic school, student learn
Vedas,
that's
it. Yes, and I wanted to learn the Vedas.
You want to learn the Vedas?
Yes, so I wanted to join this Ved Pathshala, I wanted to learn the Vedas.
Oh my God.
And so on. So
someone who really was so much into Western music now wanted to learn Vedas.
Exactly. Can you see that? Can you see that? This is what Baba's influence does, you know. It kind of takes you right from one end of the world to the other. And in a very short time, I started desiring very acutely, you know, that I wanted to see Baba and be with Baba.
So till now you had not physically seen Baba?
No, I had not seen Baba. And we didn't have videos those days. So yes. I only saw pictures. And the books that I read. And there was nobody who could tell me exactly about what Puttaparthi would be like and things like that. People had been to Puttaparthi a long time ago and, you know, those things. So they would tell me what they had seen.
The pre-internet era.
Yes, and what they had seen was the Ved Pathshala or the Ved, you know, whatever struck them, they told me. So the first time I saw Baba was in Delhi. He came to Delhi in 1981.
Okay.
So 81, when he came to Delhi, everybody got excited and they said, we must go and have Baba's darshan. I was not one of them. Because, you know, my studies were important. So my father said, my brother could go because he was in a smaller class, so he could miss his studies. But I couldn't. That was the decision made. And all the ladies, of course, you know, who were free, they all decided, including General Malhotra's wife, Mrs. Malhotra, that they would go to Delhi and they would have Baba's darshan. So tickets were booked. Railway tickets were booked.
How far is Udhampur and
Delhi? From Kashmir to Delhi.
Kashmir to Delhi.
Yeah, so you had to take a train from Jammu and then come down to Delhi. So it took a few days, I think 2 days or so those days.
Okay, so it's 2 days of travel.
Yes, 2 days of travel. But something happened, I don't remember what happened, but the situation changed. Ultimately, it was decided, because since all are ladies, there should be somebody, a male member to look after them. So I was the only one free.
Oh, is it?
So I happened suddenly to be chosen instead of my brother, who was left behind, and I was taken to Delhi. And of course, I didn't like it. I wanted to see Baba. I was very excited. But being with, you know, this group of ladies all alone was a little challenging for me. But anyway, I was given the responsibility, so I felt very important. And instead of my brother, I traveled to Delhi. And in Delhi, I first saw Baba in, you know, Mr. Sohan Lal's house.
Yes.
So Baba, first flight from the airport, he went to Sohan Lal's house. Because of Mrs. Malhotra, who was an old devotee of Baba, we also, you know, got a chance to have Baba's darshan in his house. And I remember sitting in the garden. The first thing that struck me when I saw Baba physically was, you know, he looks big in his pictures because of his hair and his hair. And when I saw him, I said, oh my God, he's so small and delicate, you know, and the way he walked. That was the first thing that struck me. And then Baba entered Sohan Lalji's house and he spent some time inside and we were waiting in the garden. I was sitting behind two Buddhist monks who had come also for his darshan. So we were waiting patiently, and then after some time, Baba appeared. He came walking down the line of devotees, and until he reached these monks, he spoke to them, and then he created vibhuti for them. And while he was creating vibhuti, he was looking at me, you know. So I was very happy. And then he gave them the vibhuti. I didn't get any. He gave them the vibhuti and he carried on. So that was my first darshan of Baba.
The first time, and you saw Swami materializing something also.
Yeah, I did. But, you know, again, it didn't strike me as something extraordinary. I took it for granted this was the power that he had. You know, I had heard of his vibhuti. I had seen a lot of his vibhuti coming out in the pictures, and, you know, his amritam being sprinkled everywhere. So I had seen all this before.
So that is not what really struck you. What struck you was his personality.
Yeah, I was looking at Baba, you know. I was just filled with joy looking at him. So, because it was my desire to see him, and when I saw him, you know, it made me feel happy. And then I just smiled at him, and he just kept on gazing at me, actually, and then he walked down. And then he went back inside. So that was my first darshan.
No verbal communication, but still enough was spoken and enough was communicated.
I don't know what was communicated. I just saw him. That I can only say that in that darshan I saw him. You know, this is the first time I saw him, and I felt happy just seeing him. But what actually happened was much later. In the evening, Baba was supposed to give a discourse in Talkatora Gardens. So there was a huge crowd, you know, lakhs of people gathered to hear his discourse. So we managed to get one seat for my mother, who could sit in front. But for me, there was no seat. So I told my mother, I said, don't worry, I'll sit wherever there is a seat. No, don't worry about it. So I was, you know, somewhere in the middle of that huge ground, Talkatora Gardens. And Baba got up to speak, First, of course, somebody introduced him, and then Baba got up to speak. I don't know what happened. This is the point where, I guess, some kind of interaction, as you said, took place. He started speaking, and his voice, the moment I heard his voice, I felt that this was the person I had been looking for all my life, you know. And there and then, in that few moments where Baba, you know, recites his poem in the beginning, during that time, the moment I heard that voice, I said, I will not eat, I will not drink, even a drop of water until Baba speaks to me. And there was a very deep urge, you know, and something very deep inside me said, he's the person I've been looking for all my life. And of course, then Baba gave his discourse and...
It was just his voice.
Yeah, it's strange, isn't it?
You don't remember what he said also exactly.
So
that was the content was not so important. It was just his presence,
yes,
his voice.
His voice, exactly. For some reason it triggered this kind of reaction in me. And it was a very, very deep urge, you know. So I made that vow there and then, and the discourse ended. We went, I didn't tell anyone. At dinner time, my mother said, why aren't you eating? And I said, no, I'm not hungry. And she, you know, being a mother, she was worried. She said, no, you must eat. No. And then I told her, I said, look, I have decided that I am not going to eat or drink even a sip of water until Baba speaks to me. And then she was alarmed, you know. She said, what will happen if Baba goes away without speaking to you? I said, then I will not eat and drink, that's all. And she said, you can't do like that, you know, you can't survive like that. I said, we will see what happens. But for now, this is my vow, and I'm not going to. And, you know, she, when we used to go for Baba Darshan, and in between the morning and evening Darshan, she would take me to a place, you know, where my favorite Golgappas were waiting, chaat and Golgappas.
Yes.
And, you know, she would try to tempt me, but nothing could tempt me. And I was, you know, very firm about the fact that I'm not going to eat. My aunts, my uncles, they all came and they tried to, you know, I was a young boy, so they think this boy is crazy, something
some
happened.
Sudden flash in the pan kind of inspiration.
And said, you know, this is not the way, you know, if you want to speak to him, you know, people gave me all sorts of advice, so, but you must eat, you must, and I just listened quietly, I didn't say anything. Then we were fortunate to get another invitation to, you know, Bharati Vidya Bhavan, where Baba had to give a speech.
This was the third or fourth day of Baba's?
Second or third day.
So it's one whole day without food?
Yeah, I think more than a day. I can tell you in advance. Baba spoke to me on the last day.
Oh my God. And how many days
did
Baba stay?
I think he stayed for about 5 or 6 days in
God.
Delhi.
Penance.
Yes.
Sairam, dear listeners, and welcome back to Morning Glory, coming to you live from Prashanthi Nilayam, India, where the time right now is 4 minutes past 11 a.m. Today is the 7th of November, 2013. We hope you enjoyed this fleeting moments interview with Mr. Gautam Dutt. We will bring you part 2 and several more parts of this conversation right here on Morning Glory every Thursday. So please be sure to tune in. Your feedback to this conversation is very important to us. Please tell us what's on your mind. You can reach us at listener@radiosci.org. And now, it's time for me to offer morning glory at the lotus feet of our beloved Bhagwan Sri Sathya Sai Baba. Till we meet next Thursday, please be well, keep seeking, and do whatever it takes to be happy and positive. Now till Brother Raghu signs in with service, love in action, please enjoy the bhajan Prata Smaranam Sri Ramam in Sai Krishna's voice from our Bhavanjali series. Sai Ram.
स्मरणं श्रीरामम् स्मरणं श्रीरामम् मुनिजनसेवित श्रीरामम् मुनिजनसेवित श्रीरामम् मुनिजनसेवित श्रीरामम् मुनिजनसेवित श्रीरामम् प्रातः स्मरणं श्रीरामम् प्रातः स्मरणं श्रीरामम् आनन्ददायक श्रीरामम् आनन्ददायक श्रीरामम् आनन्ददायक श्रीरामम् आनन्ददायक श्रीरामम् मोक्षप्रदायक श्रीरामम् मोक्षप्रदायक श्रीराम मोक्षप्रदायक श्रीराम भज मनसाई रामम रामम भज मनसाई रामम रामम
भज मनसाई रामम
प्रातः स्मरणं श्रीरामम
प्रातः स्मरणं श्रीरामम
मुनिजन सेवित श्रीरामम
श्रीरामम्
प्रातः स्मरणं श्रीरामम्
प्रातः स्मरणं
श्रीरामम् आनन्ददायक श्रीरामम्
आनन्ददायक श्रीरामम्
मोक्षप्रदायक श्रीराम
मोक्षप्रदायक श्रीराम
भज मनसाई रामम रामम
भज मनसाई रामम रामम
भज मनसाई रामम रामम
भज मनसाई
प्रातः स्मरणं श्रीराम.